I'm grateful that we have this program. And my life is not like it used to be. And it isn't like it used to be because this program works. And the grace of God is amazing and ever-present. And so my life is getting better. And I, like you, have looked around in this program since I've been here, and I have found one here and one there and one over there and one in another state and many different ones that I wanted to be like. This person would have been in the program for a while, and one look and you could tell that they've got something. And I could say, this person has something I want. And so I'd latch on to them, and I would drain as much as I could off for myself. And our speaker this morning is one of those that I latched on about 2 years ago when I heard her tell her story, and it was one that I could identify with. One look at her, and you know that she's got something. She's lovely, and she is loved by all who know her. And if you don't know her, you will love her after this morning. I give to you now from Casey, South Carolina, Margaret H.
Hi, everybody. My name is Margaret, and first, before I forget it, I do want to thank the conference committee for these beautiful flowers and for the many courtesies that they've extended my husband and I while we've been here. We're having a wonderful time, and it is a joy to be with you. I also want to thank the Georgia AAs and Al-Anons for asking me to come and share with you my experiences, strengths, and hope. Because, you see, I know that the Al-Anon program will work for the non-alcoholic just as the AA program will work for the alcoholic if we'll let it. My name is Margaret, and I am the mother of two children, a daughter, 22, and a son, 20. I'm also the grateful wife of a man who suffers from the disease of alcoholism. Because first, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for his disease. And second, I might be languishing in the Liberty County Jail if it wasn't for the fact that he had $20 Thursday night as we came down to Jekyll Island. And I was stopped by a patrolman, turned over to a deputy sheriff, and all I had was a checkbook, and he said, we don't take personal checks, and so my husband had a $20 bill, and here I am. I am a member of the Palmetto Group of Casey, South Carolina, an Al-Anon group, and I would like to tell you that since I've come into Al-Anon and my husband into AA, that all is sweetness and light at our house, but you know, this is an honest program, and this would not be true because we're too much like the farmer and his wife who had been feuding for several days. And they started the town in this two-horse wagon, and the wife was sitting on one side and the husband on the other, not speaking. You know how that is. And finally, the wife could stand it no longer, and she looked over at her husband, and she said, oh, John, why can't we pull together like this team of horses? And John thought a minute and spit his tobacco and said, well, I guess we could if we just had one tongue between us. So everything isn't sweetness and light, but it is interesting at our house. We hear a great deal in Al-Anon about educating the public, and I think this is real good. But I feel that we also need to establish a little more understanding, communication, and cooperation between the fellowships of AA and Al-Anon. As Bob mentioned, cooperation but not affiliation. And I would also like to state that what I say are my own opinions and do not necessarily reflect the thinking of Al-Anon as a whole. Joni has told you what Al-Anon is. How does it work? Well, first it tells us to begin with ourselves, to listen, to learn, to attend AA meetings, to attend Al-Anon meetings, and then to apply what we learn to our lives. And it provides us with tools with which to work and with which to correct our character defects. Many people know very little about the impact of alcoholism on the family. How do I know? Well, one said to me one night, "What do you do at those Al-Anon meetings anyway, roast your husbands?" And I explained, no, we didn't roast our husbands. We tried to learn something for ourselves. Some think that Al-Anon meetings are of no importance at all, because one said to me one time when I inquired about a certain party that was having a little problem with his drinking, that guy would probably get straightened out if his wife would go to hell. Well, this might be true, but I imagine that the wife was already in hell and she was just trying to find a way out, and she hadn't been able to latch on to this avenue of escape as yet. And this is why she felt like she did and acted like she did. And then some AAs think of us as normal people who have looked after everything over a period of years. And sometimes we think we're normal people. The reason I know that AAs feel this way, one said to me one time, "You know, I never knew before I heard you speak that non-AAs had any problems. And I had never known before that anybody had as many problems as we have." But alcoholics aren't the only ones that don't understand these programs, because one day when I was sitting in the lobby of a hotel in Alabama at a Southeastern convention, a lady came in and sat down beside me. And we looked into the coffee room from whence came sounds of merriment, and she said to me, "Don't you think that those folks in there are a bunch of hypocrites?" I didn't know what to say, really. But I had to say no. I couldn't say they all were. Possibly some were, but not all of them. And then she went on to relate to me a story of hostility, resentment, and jealousy that was really hard to believe. And when I asked her, "Do you attend Al-Anon?" she said, "No, my husband would like for me to, but there's nothing wrong with me." I couldn't criticize her too much, because you see, I had been in the same boat for many years. But Al-Anon taught me that there were many areas of my life that needed cleaning up and straightening out. And as I listened, I began to see that I did have character defects, that I wasn't everything that I thought I was. Truly, alcoholism is a family disease. AA's own Bill Wilson says that it's impossible to live in the house with active alcoholism over a period of years without becoming more or less neurotic oneself. The director of the Charlotte Council on Alcoholism says that very often the person nearest to the alcoholic needs more assistance and counseling than does the alcoholic himself. And a judge of the New York Domestic Relations Court has made the statement that if understanding which can support cure is to be achieved in alcoholic households, then the family should attend Al-Anon when the alcoholic attends the AA meetings. I wonder how many of you have ever heard an AA coming back from a 12-step call and said, "Brother, if I had a wife like that, I'd be drunk too. No wonder that guy's an alcoholic." And I'm sure that he has a point. But wouldn't you have to know the folks before the drinking or when they were first married to know whether the drinking led to the neuroses or the neuroses led to the drinking? And really, what difference does it make? Because at this point, both need help. And AA and Al-Anon have the tools to provide assistance in this instance. For many years, I couldn't understand this frightening malady that had affected our home and that was wrecking our lives. And I could readily agree when we came into AA that it was a spiritual disease that combined a mental obsession and a physical compulsion to drink and keep on drinking once alcohol entered the system. And I learned that the alcoholic went down the road of active alcoholism to degradation and death if this disease was not arrested. These people deserve our help, and we learned in Al-Anon that one of the purposes is to offer understanding and encouragement to the alcoholic in the family. But what of these other normal people that haven't had the tranquilizing effect of alcohol to deaden the hurt and relieve the tension and erase the responsibility? These people that have had to cope with the problems of being the mother and the father and the breadwinner and the housekeeper and the carpenter and the plumber and this thing and that thing, of having to cope with alcoholic sprees, resentments, lies, jealousies, flying chips, big shot schemes, sometimes physical abuse. The alcoholic has the oblivion of alcohol from time to time, but the non-alcoholic has stark reality, day in and day out. Really, it's no wonder, I guess, that we become such cynical, hateful, unresponsive wrecks as we do become, because actually we are emotionally sick people, although many times we're the last to realize it, or if we realize it, we're sometimes the last to admit that we are. Certainly you can't know our problems unless you've experienced some of them. I wonder how many of you have ever made a date with your husband to celebrate a wedding anniversary, and you're to meet at 6 o'clock and get ready to go out, and so you rush home and you bathe and dress and you hum a happy tune, and 6 o'clock arrives and you're ready to go. No husband. 6:30 comes, your heart begins to pound, you have pains in your stomach. 7 o'clock arrives, you're pacing the floor like a caged lion. 8 o'clock arrives, and you think, well, maybe my husband's been unavoidably detained. Well, by 8:30, you know you were a complete fool for having entertained such a ridiculous notion as this. And although you swear you don't care how many cars slow down, you will not look for them. Every car that slows finds you, lights turned out, peering out the blind like a hunted criminal dodging the sheriff. Finally, you're exhausted, and you go to bed, and you lie there, and you try not to think of the other guy that you could have married who's a pillar in the community. He's well off. His family drives a big car. You try not to hope that if your husband does have a wreck that he'll kill himself so your anxious days will be ended, and you hope he won't kill somebody else. But near daylight, soon the alarm goes off, and you get up, you gulp down a cup of coffee, and as you leave the house, who should drive up but your rest wrecker? Do you speak to him like you would your next-door neighbor's husband who had been out all night drunk? No, you turn your nose up in the air. You have 1,000 questions you want to ask, but you wouldn't give him the satisfaction of knowing you care. You turn your nose in the air, you trip haughtily down the road on foot to work, your eyes burning with tears, filled with rage, resentment, and all the other things, including self-pity. Or has your husband ever been a guest in the county jail? And you sit at home, fearful and anxious, lonely, frightened, shades drawn, doors locked, to try to protect you from prying eyes and tattling tongues, you think. And all of a sudden, the phone, which you've forgotten to take off the hook, rings. It's your husband's long-suffering boss, and he said, "Where is Joe this morning? He hadn't shown up for work." And the first thing you no, you're thinking, what must I tell him? What excuse did I use last? And all of them go through your mind, and finally you hear yourself saying, well, Joe wanted to come this morning, but he was so sick. He has a virus, and he will be in the morning if he can possibly make it. Well, you hang up, and you're filled with a sense of guilt, shame, because you see you're a basically honest person, and here for the umpteenth time you've lied, and you don't know what to do. But when your hapless husband arrives home reinforced with alcoholism to face the music which he knows he's going to have to endure, your emotions boil over, and the first thing you know, you're cursing him with cursing words that would make a drunken sailor blush with shame. And after the venom has spent itself, you suddenly become aware that looking at you are several sets of eyes, and their look seems to inquire, who on earth is this foul-mouthed stranger? This surely couldn't be our mother, whom we loved and trusted, who taught us to say our prayers, to love people, to use nice, fine language. Who on earth is this foul-mouthed stranger? And you become upset, and you scream at them to go to bed. And if they don't go when you tell them, you jerk them up and see that they do get in bed. They're confused. You're confused. And a little later on, there you are in the front room on the bumpy couch, tossing to and fro, praying God to forgive you for your ugliness, seeking guidance for your children, help for your husband, imploring heaven for a solution to your problems, and help seems to be completely out of reach. Or has your husband ever insisted on going to a stag party against your strong objections? Swearing he'll be home by midnight, he leaves the gloomy sanctuary of home. 1 a.m. finds you frightened. You jump at every creak of the house. You toss, you tumble, you threaten to do him bodily harm if or when he ever does arrive back home. You inventory every single anxious incident of the past. You grow more alarmed, angry, and violent as the minutes tick away. 2 a.m., a car stops, and so does your heart. You strain your ears to hear his unsteady step and his fumbling key, and you don't hear a thing in this world. And all of a sudden, the door opens, and in steps your husband, sober as the judge, exuding joy. You could kill him. Confusion, we know that too. Or has your lubricated lover ever come in about 3 a.m. in the morning? And as soon as his labored breathing assures you that he's reached alcoholic oblivion, you're up and at him like an accomplished upper story man trying to find money to keep the lights and water on or buy food or some other frantic cold. And your search discloses certain feminine names and telephone numbers. Does it ever occur to you that these might be legitimate names and telephone numbers? No, it surely does not. You forget about the needs in the family, and you crawl back in bed, and you think, what should I do? Call these women and tell them to come get him? Should I drown the children? Shoot myself? Shoot my husband? What is the best thing for all concerned? Again, you doze off from exhaustion, but when the alarm goes off, you're supposed to arise bright and smiling and scatter sunshine and light in silence. Sympathize with his hungover self, and your chief desire in life is to cut his throat. Not swiftly, but slowly. With a dull, jagged, rusty knife, you want him to endure all the torture and the terror and the torment that you've endured. And when he decides to leave the house, you find yourself asking, where are you going? What time will you be back? And who is going to be there? Slowly but surely, the vicious tentacles of the octopus of alcohol do reach out, and they squeeze from every marriage all the normal love and emotions that most people, or normal people, should feel one for another. Not once, but many times, we cry out to God to let us die. One night we were at a rehabilitation center and this non-alcoholic was speaking and she said, "You know, I bet I've cried this room full of tears over my husband." Two people were sitting behind us, two men, and one said to the other one, "You know that's not so." And I thought of the many, many times I'd come home after a hard day's work at the office to a cold, empty, bottle-strewn house, no husband, drunk or sober, and thrown myself across the bed and cried out hysterically to God to let me die, not caring if I alarmed the whole neighborhood or not. Maybe this man's wife didn't cry and plead and go home to mama. Maybe she cursed and fought and flirted. Because we do forget to cry sooner or later. The symptoms vary, but the basic cause is the same. We're caught in the whirling cage created by alcoholism. And we're too overcome by our own insanity to stop, to be still, and look for the latch that can unlock the door and let us out on solid ground. We also undergo certain changes in our attitude and action and personality as we skid down the rocky road created by alcoholism. And unless a power greater than ourselves is found, we end up in several different ways. Some of us pour out our troubles to anybody that will bend their ear. Others of us wouldn't say a word to anybody. We go into a shell and won't communicate at all. Some become involved in activities that exclude the alcoholic in their home. Some become alcoholics themselves. Others try to commit suicide. Some end up in penitentiaries or mental institutions. I know some in each one of these categories. One night we were coming home from a party and we noticed the police cars around the house. We stopped. There in the yard stood a young girl about 17 with a baby in her arms, and she was crying as though her heart would break. We learned later that she had just shot her husband as they struggled over a gun following a drinking bout. He had been drinking for several days. The next time I saw her, she was in the woman's prison near Columbia. One night my telephone rang about 11:30 and the hysterical voice of a friend of mine, the mother of four children, said, "Miss Margaret, can I park my car in your yard and sleep there tonight? I've just tried to kill my husband." When she came to herself, she was on top of him, choking the life out of him. She was so frightened, she jumped up, grabbed her clothes, threw him in the car, left her children, and started out. She didn't know where. She thought of me and called. And I said, "Come on." And that night she spent on that bumpy couch in our front room. One Saturday our phone rang and this voice told me some problems that she was having. First time we'd met this lady, she was recuperating from a suicide attempt. We went over, got her, kept her at our house that day, took her back that night. 2 months ago, my phone rang and a nurse in the psychiatric ward of a local hospital said, "Are you Mrs. Harbin?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "Would you please come and bring the little booklet just for today? A friend of yours feels like she can face this week a little better if she has this piece of literature." No, we cry, but we don't die. We just go on living, fussing, fuming, fighting, wallowing in self-pity, hurt pride, resentment, and sometimes a little self-righteousness creeps in along the way. We too need help, and another purpose of Al-Anon is to offer friendship, comfort, and hope to the families of alcoholics. I was born in a home where we knew the love of God and the security of devoted parents. I was aware of the existence of alcohol, but I was totally oblivious to the fact that it was as powerful as it is. We moved to this little town, and there when I was 17, I began to date this handsome, happy-go-lucky fellow who was much different from myself. I knew that he drank. I knew that his home life was most unhappy. I knew that he ran around with the drinking crowd, but I felt that with my charm and my love and my stabilizing influence that I could make a good, outstanding citizen out of him. And I was half right because both of us became quite well known in the small town in which we lived. And so we were married when I was 19 and he was 21. And I knew all. I was much like this girl. A cartoon came out in the paper one time and it showed this young lady standing on one corner of the stage clasping a diploma in her hand. She was wearing a cap and gown. And on the other side of the stage stood a little man depicting Mr. World with the look of wisdom and experience on his face. And he looked over at her and he said, "Ah, who have we here?" And she drew herself up quite proudly and she said, "Evidently you don't know me. I'm Virginia Cordelia Smith, A.B. And he said, "Come with me and I'll teach you the rest of the alphabet." And so I was kind of like that. At first, when my husband would come home in the wee hours of the morning and say, "I've had two beers and a flat tire," I believed every word he said. At first, when he would come home and the next day be nursing a hangover and swear, "I'll never take another drink as long as I live," I believed every word he said. But slowly and surely, the light began to dawn, and I became frightened that something strange and terrible was really wrong with him. The years rocked by, and one Sunday night I found myself at a beer and poker party in an apartment across from where we lived. The smoke filled the room, the conversation became rather revolting, and I went out on the back porch to get a little fresh air. And as I stood there, I looked across at a little church on the corner. The lights were on, the music was coming from there. They were singing, and I thought back of other years when I would have been in a church on Sunday night. And I resolved in my heart that my husband could go to hell if he wanted to, but I was going to try to do something about me. AA and Al-Anon weren't heard of in those days, but I took a part of step four, a very fleeting inventory. And I went to this little church, and I sat there. I didn't worry about whether the preacher was running around with the organist or the deacons were dating the choir girls. I went to try to find out some help from God through the minister for Margaret. I got this help. Things rocked along and World War II arrived and was close to the end. And I went out to California to meet my husband, armed with some advice from a cousin. She said, "What's wrong with you is you don't drink with your husband. Now, I drink with mine and he looks after me to keep me sober. He doesn't want me to get drunk." So I arrived in California and I decided I would drink with my husband. But my husband wasn't like her husband, and I wasn't like she was, and so I had to give this up as a pretty bad job. By 1948, we were back home, and we were faced with a choice at our house of death or AA, and AA was called and help arrived, and we went to the meetings, and we sat there, and I looked at the 12 steps that were on the board. And I took step four for my husband every single meeting. I just prayed that he would get this program. And it never occurred to me that there was anything in here at all that could help me. Sobriety followed. Long periods of sobriety. And I was on cloud nine. Long about this time, 1951, I had to go to the hospital for surgery. And while I was there, a card arrived. And it said down in the bottom, 2 Timothy 2:15. Now, I went to church every time the doors opened, but I didn't know what that was, and so I got the Bible in the room out, thanks to the Gideons, and I read, "Study, to show thyself approved unto God, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth." Well, I saw red. How dare this woman send such a verse to me, a fine, upstanding Christian in my own eyes. I fumed and smoldered, but I couldn't go anywhere. And a still small voice said to me, "Study?" And I had to say, "No, read, yes." That's what I did. And I began to study, and I began to learn. And as I improved my conscious contact with God, as I understood Him, good old step 11, I did see myself as I was, a petty, self-righteous, despicable person, as I compared myself not to my next-door neighbor, but to my Savior. Because God, as I understand Him, not as you may understand Him, is revealed through His Son, Jesus Christ, who has left me an example in whose steps I can attempt to follow. Knowing I'll never reach perfection, but at least having a goal to strive for, Sir Philip Sidney has said, "Who shooteth at the noonday sun, though his aim be true, he will never reach his mark, yet he will shoot higher than he who aims but at a bush." Strangely, after this time, I no longer felt disdain, but compassion for those whom before I had thought of as trash and riffraff. I realized that they had their problems just as I had mine. They were misguided in their way, just as I was in mine. Later, we again waded through the desperate circumstances of active alcoholism, and in 1959, following a crisis in our home, we came back to AA, and this time I came into Al-Anon. I think I was pretty much like the ants I heard a friend tell about. He said that this man went out to play golf, and he took the little ball, and he put it down on an anthill, and he took a wicked swing, and dead ants flew everywhere. The ball dropped down in the anthill. He again took a swing, missed the ball, dead ants again went everywhere. The third time he repeated the performance, and the next time he started to take a swing, there were two little ants left, and one said, "We better get on the ball if we expect to survive." And so this was the way it was with me. At a Florida convention not too many years ago, I heard a man say, "Isn't it strange that princes and kings and clowns that caper in sawdust rings and common folks like you and me are builders for eternity? To each is given a set of rules, a shapeless mass and a bag of tools, and each must build ere life is flown, a stumbling block or a stepping stone." You know, I think that these programs take from the Bible basic steps and put them into simple steps and mottos that my muddled up mind can grasp and put to work in my life to help implement the rules. To me, the Bible is my book of rules, my life the shapeless mass, and the Al-Anon program my set of tools. The rule book says, "Seek ye first the kingdom of God." The tool chest says, "First things first." The rule book says, "Be not anxious for tomorrow." The tool chest says, 24 hours, take it easy, just for today. The rule book says, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge Him and He will direct thy path." And the tool chest says, "Let go and let God." Let's face it, the past is gone. We must forgive if we're to be forgiven. And I really believe that if we would work as hard at forgiving and forgetting as we do at remembering and reminding, that we'd have much happier homes in which to live. And I believe that forgiveness is a must if we're to have peace of mind. This has helped me. This is one thing that doesn't bother me anymore, because I remembered that Jesus forgave people spitting in His face, pushing thorns down into His head, driving nails into His hand and feet. And if He could say, "Father, forgive them," surely I can forgive those that have done little things against me. As we use these tools to implement these rules, we do change unconsciously. I realized this several years ago when I was invited to Blue Ridge and we were having problems. I thought, "Oh, I can't go. I have nothing to say." Several weeks went by, and one morning I was in my kitchen, and as I washed dishes, I heard a bird singing. I saw a little boy pedaling up the road on his bicycle. About that time, our son came into the room. And we began to laugh and talk. And suddenly I realized that here in this very same room under similar circumstances several years ago, I had been screaming, yelling, whirling around in circles, not knowing what I was doing or saying. This was a miracle because here I was, calm, restored to sanity, thanks to these programs. Certainly, we do start living when we give up crying and start trying. Sometimes I sit down and count my blessings, and most of them came disguised as unwanted, seemingly unbearable, and certainly misunderstood trials, which later proved to be a source of strength and love and understanding to be shared. I'm grateful for my husband, whom I almost lost a few short years ago. I'm grateful for the insight into my own shortcomings I've gained through these programs. I'm grateful for the relief I felt when I took step one and realized that I must stop trying to manage my husband's life if I expected to manage my own life. I'm especially grateful for the serenity prayer. With the first word, God, our souls just naturally look up. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. We have two choices. We can fight against them or we can accept them if we cannot change them. Fighting will only leave us tired, irritated, and frustrated, our hearts bruised and battered, and our minds cluttered with ugly thoughts. Acceptance brings relief for our frayed nerves. It brings release for our burdened hearts, and it brings clearness for our cluttered brains so that we can take constructive action. God, grant me the courage to change the things I can. Grant me the courage to shut my mouth and open my ears. Clarence S. said we were given two ears and one mouth, so the answer should be obvious. Grant me the courage to change self-condemnation to self-examination. Part of us have been called low-down, drunken bums so many times we believe we are this. Some of us have been told how stupid and ignorant we are until we believe this. We're all God's children, created in His image, precious in His sight. Let's stand up and act like it. God, grant me the courage to change dishonesty to honesty. Someone has said the more we think and act honestly, the more of a habit it becomes. Let's change bitterness to happiness. The Bible says a happy heart doeth good like medicine. Al-Anon teaches, just for today, I will be happy. Abraham Lincoln once said that most folks are as happy as they make up their minds to be. God, grant me the courage to weed out nagging. Drinking is stopped a drink at a time. Nagging is stopped a nag at a time. God, grant me the courage to change fear to faith. In Al-Anon, we're told if we will supply the willingness, God will supply the power. The rule book says, what time I'm afraid, I will trust in thee. And our programs tell us, let go and let God. Grant me the courage to change hostility to kindness. I read one time, kindness is letting the little fellow feel big. Kindness is being quiet. Sometimes kindness is doing what seems to be cruel things, like taking your baby to get hurtful penicillin shots when you know without them he may die, and crying along with him, but knowing it has to be done. So sometimes kindness is withdrawing support from the alcoholic so he'll learn to stand on his own two feet. Courage to change loneliness to friendliness. Someone has said many people are lonely because they build walls instead of bridges. Courage to change self-righteousness to self-examination. Sometimes when I'm tempted to think too highly of myself, I try to remember, who am I to look with contempt on anyone? For haven't I cursed like a sailor, fought like the riffraff I condemned, lied as though I never knew the truth? Boast not of garments all unscorched by sin, till you have walked unscathed through fires within. God, grant me the wisdom to know the difference. Don't ask for wisdom if you don't want it, because James 1:5 says, if you lack wisdom, ask of God, and it will be given you. I believe that wisdom is gained kind of like the alphabet Mr. Wells spoke of, by putting to work each day the knowledge gained the day before. To me, these programs are sent from God to us who suffer from or through the disease of alcoholism. We learn what it is, symptoms to chart its course, and steps to take to alleviate the suffering. Is Al-Anon as necessary as AA? You decide. In 1960, we had a Southeastern convention in Columbia, and a lady read in the paper that this was going on. She came, we had an Al-Anon booth set up, she talked with some of us. She began to attend Al-Anon meetings. She tried to apply what she learned, and in a few months, several months, her husband started coming to AA. He picked up his 5-year chip just a few months back. Now they have a sober, happy family. In 1966, my husband had had a stroke. He was in the hospital, and this couple I've just told about had come over to sit with him. And I had rushed home to try to get a little rest. The phone rang incessantly, and I hadn't gotten any rest. And as I started to hang up from a call, I said, I will not answer this phone again. I have got to have some rest and clean up just a bit. But as I hung it up, the phone rang, and as a reflex motion, I picked it up, and this sobbing voice said, oh, I'm so glad I got you. I'd prayed so hard you'd answer, and your phone's been so busy. And I thought, oh, no, Lord, I can't talk to this woman. And I thought of all the problems I had, and all of a sudden, I remembered. Eloise and Champ were with my husband. There was nothing I could really do. And here was someone desperate for help, and I listened. And we talked, and we laughed, and when I hung up, you know, we both felt better. Several years ago, my telephone rang. It was an Al-Anon. An AA in the county seat had called and asked that she go and call on this girl. A fella was on the chain gang up there. He was worried about his wife and 3 small children, and he had called and asked this fella to see about her. So we went to see the wife, a more forlorn figure I've never seen. She was expecting a child any minute. She invited us in, not too cordially. We sat down and shared our experiences, strengths, and hope. Left because we just never expected to see her again, but she came to Al-Anon. Time went on. The baby came. Her husband got off the chain gang. He came to AA. He got a job. About 3 years later, the girl and I were washing dishes. And she said to me, isn't it wonderful not to have to worry anymore when your husband's a little late getting home at night? So you see, unity of purpose can help desperate families survive today and build a bridge of hope for a better tomorrow. Most of us have been real blessed, and maybe we don't realize it. We should put to work these blessings that we have received to alleviate the suffering all around us. What blessings have we received? Listen. He prayed for strength that he might achieve. He was made weak that he might obey. He prayed for health that he might do great things. He was given infirmity that he might do better things. He prayed for riches that he might be happy. He was given poverty that he might be wise. He prayed for power that he might feel the praise of men. He was given weakness that he might feel the need of God. He prayed for all things that he might enjoy life. He was given life that he might enjoy all things. He had received nothing he asked for, all that he hoped for. His prayer was answered. He was most blessed. No, I'm not the person I want to be. I'm not the person I hope to be. I'm not the person I know I can be. But thanks to the grace of God, His book of rules, the AA and Al-Anon program, I'm not the person I used to be. Thank you.